Well, hello everyone, and thank you for listening to this podcast episode. My name's Daniel, and I'm very privileged and honored that you would spend a little bit of time listening to one beggar sharing his bread with you. So, what I want to talk about today is the Four Noble Truths. They're found in Buddhism, and in my day-to-day walk, I've decided to do a kind of systematic study of Buddhism, and it's taken a little while to try and figure out, well, where do you begin with such things, you know? Buddhism is such a complex philosophy, religion, whatever you want to call it, and it seems to me that a good place to start is with the Four Noble Truths. It's recognized as the Buddha's first series of teachings. And so what I am planning to do in this episode is to share with you the first noble truth, or the first, I think they pronounce it, Iran truth. And the first truth that came from the mouth of the Buddha is dukkha. In other words, suffering. The truth of suffering. Suffering comes in many forms, doesn't it? It comes psychologically. It comes physically. It can come from... It just comes in many forms. It comes through obvious means. We recognize suffering through the obvious, such as death, illness, old age, decay. It can come through means as, you know, past trauma, family meltdowns, family arguments, disputes with friends, bullying, gossip, nuances, mental health, past traumatic memories. There are so many different forms and types of suffering. It's just unlimited. We suffer through anger, jealousy, lust. We have this philosophy, certainly in the Western world, of materialism, that pleasure brings about happiness. We want it quick. We want it easy. For example, you know, men that I've spoke to over the years about who've struggled with pornography, it gives a form of satisfaction, but that satisfaction doesn't last. And that's the thing, and this is what the Buddha implies here, that the things that we desire, they don't satisfy us. We're looking for things that are lasting. We are made, constructed, evolved, whatever you want to call it, in such a way where the things that we want them to last forever. For example, there's nothing wrong. I've got to be careful with using the word wrong, but there's nothing wrong with desiring to be, like for me, for example, to be with my wife all my life. I want my wife to live forever, and I want to live forever, and I want us to live and be married forever. But I know forever is just a delusional concept. It's not real. That's not the case. But because I want that to happen, because I want to die, for example, at the same time as my wife, that could be the case. At the age of 95, should we say, a nice long life. I know that sort of attachment, that sort of desire will produce some sort of suffering, be it obvious or nuanced. It's an attachment. It's a resistance against the natural truth of impermanence, which, in other words, is things that don't last forever. It's everything in this world is in a state of constant flux. Everything is changing, and we don't do change. Out of interest, one of the things I love about Christianity, for example, whether you believe God to be true or not, is that there's a scripture in the Bible where it's declared that God is the same today, tomorrow, and was yesterday. He is, as many of you know, eternal. And that concept alone provides for many Christians and for other people of different religious beliefs who believe in their gods. Generally speaking, that sort of truth that comes from those scriptures provide tremendous amounts of comfort, because it's like, well, that's something I can build my life upon. That's something that's foundational. It's that the foundations are secure, eternally secure, in fact. An interesting idea. Well, one of the things I understand with Buddhism is that it doesn't necessarily lean towards and spends lots of time in the metaphysical, but rather it spends a lot of its time and attention in the here and now of this present reality. And the present reality and what comes out of the First Noble Truth is that everything is impermanent. And because we like permanence, because we want things to last for a very long time, or if not forever, this will produce suffering. The pleasures that we enjoy, they don't last. For example, the moments where we're with our friends and we've drunk a lot of wine, we want those moments to last, but they don't. Eventually you wake up the next morning, and in my case, many times, it's been with a terrible hangover, suffering physically. So to desire is to suffer. Wrong desire is to suffer. But in our very own being and nature, we all have a desire to be ultimately happy. And the Four Noble Truths help us lead to that state, that and or that place of ultimate happiness. So when we think about this First Noble Truth, for many in the Western culture, this might be felt as a depressing, nihilistic, pessimistic experience, but it's not. It's one of reality. It's very realistic. You don't have to look far until you find suffering happening in this world. And if you spend a little moment of contemplation in why people suffer, you can see that actually it's rooted in the desire for things to be permanent. And yet the reality is that things are impermanent. So other words we can use that are translated from the word dukkha. We've said suffering, but you could reword it as anguish. Or pain, or as a kind of elaborating to unsatisfactoriness. It's like hunger. When you eat something, for a time you feel full, you poo it out, and then you're hungry again. It's this endless cycle. Over and over and over and over again. It's ironic, isn't it? The moment we have junk food and we stuff ourselves with junk food, like I do sometimes, you have this big desire and conviction to be like, you know what, I'm going to lose weight. This is it. That's it. I'm done. Because it's the state, your mental state, your physical state as well, that you're in. But the moment you're hungry again, the desire to lose weight, to exercise, to eat a little bit more healthier, it's not so strong, because you want that wholesome experience again. But the wholesome experience, the illusion of eating, for example, a pizza, which makes you feel wholesome afterwards, is an illusion. That's what you think, but it's not the case. And I think that's another way, perhaps, of describing ultimate happiness. It's to feel whole. To feel satisfied. And This reality of impermanence, again, this is not subjective. Impermanence, in one sense, can be to our favor, and in another sense, not to our favor, but what really matters is not the external aspect of impermanence, it's how you interpret the situation. For example, impermanence that might be in your favor could be, for example, with a work colleague. They're gossiping about you, they're saying horrible things about you, and the next moment, they're moving on to another job, or they're dead, or some other person's been at the heart of the gossip. In that sense, it's to your favor. But in another way, thinking about the situation, that's what's more important, isn't it? It's how you project, how you experience those things. And these are very Stoic principles, particularly, you know, Epictetus was very hot on, you know, what's in your control and what's not in your control. And what's in our control is becoming aware of the nature of suffering. And this is why the Buddha and so many, I presume, religious Buddhists, scholars, philosophers, who explain the First Noble Truth in great detail, is because in order to understand the cure, in order to get the cure, you must understand the disease. The First Noble Truth reminds me a lot of the 5 points of Calvinism, because the first point of Calvinism is the total depravity of man, which is, in other words, the explanation of why there is so much, in a Christian's point of view, so much sin in the world, and why we commit evil. And to have a deep, profound understanding from a Christian perspective of original sin, the nature of ourselves, which without Christ and without being regenerated by the Holy Spirit is sin, we will experience and treat the grace of God as shallow, the gospel as shallow. Other people, we would still have a sense of snobbery. But if we have a deep understanding, being a sage of human nature, we don't put ourselves higher than anyone else. In fact, we put ourselves subservient because we have the knowledge and the understanding of why things the way they are, and we treat people differently. So if someone treats you poorly, depending on your view, could be the First Noble Truth or the doctrine of total depravity, you take the sting out of what they say and actually say, well, you know what? I feel sorry for you, because that you're expressing your sinful nature, or you're speaking in a way that comes from a sense of suffering. You are suffering in yourself. You're not at peace. You're not happy. You don't feel whole. So it takes the sting out of what they say, the effect. So that's a first big payoff of why you ought to be so familiar with suffering and spend much time in this. And this is something I plan to do in my personal studies of Buddhism, is perhaps not to rush too quickly. But reading, I remember what the Dalai Lama was saying, is being prepared to actually put hard work in, is actually being disciplined and taking my time in understanding these lofty truths. The situations are subject to change. And because situations are subject to change, they in themselves, of how we interpret them and how we deal with it, can produce and does produce suffering. So understanding the nature, getting a clarity, seeing the bigger picture, seeing the root of suffering, causes us then to be in a position where we can then begin to deal with the suffering. So how do you deal with the suffering? Well, you can't eliminate suffering in itself. But what you can do is identify the causes of those sufferings and deal with that. Generally speaking, in my experience, most of my suffering comes from my own mental projection, comes from a sense of denial, a sense of pity, ignorance being clouded, lack of knowledge. And it's a sense of, it's a sense of not willing myself to go against the grain in that sense, not violating the principles of Wu Wei or anything, but actually, rather than responding in aggression or in anxiety, I respond with kindness. and peace. So, for example, the practice of, and I've mentioned this before in the other podcast episode, Tonglen. For example, I work in mental health. If it's a client that I struggle with, for example, on an emotional level, that makes me find it more difficult and challenging to be that person that I need to be, that holistic, therapeutic person, I will visualize that person in my mind. I'll breathe in, imagining I'm breathing in their suffering, their darkness, their smoke, and then I breathe out light upon that person with a sense of kindness, wishing them blessings and peace. That might not do anything in reality, that sense of meditation, not to destroy the mystical, magical parts of all of this. It might, I don't know. But what it does do, psychologically, at the very least, is that it makes me approachable. It deflates first my ego and my self-absorption. It deflates that. It deflates who this person really is, because he's not the person in my mind's eye. He is who he is and rooted in reality. But it makes me then approachable. It makes me one, I'd like to think, who is actually, just approachable. It's a very therapeutic way of dealing with it. So the way to eliminate suffering is by eliminating the causes of suffering. The causes. So it's being objective. And this is where meditation is important. It's identifying what parts in your life, that the things that you're struggling with right now, what are those causes? And generally, like I say, you'll find it starts with your own mental projections of how you're interpreting the situation. So you start with self first. So a couple of key words then with the first noble truth of suffering is the word dukkha, which is the original word. The word impermanence, that's an important word in trying to get a better understanding of this first truth. And then this word attachment. And like I say, for example, there are attachments that are rooted in love. But we have to be careful. For example, I love my wife so much. She nearly died at one point. She lost a lot of weight due to her illness. Thank God she's better now. But I nearly lost her. And the thought of losing her, and even now, still causes me to feel grief. Now, this is not to say that we are to become emotionless, like a robot or anything. That's not the point. We are to feel things. I mean, for example, Seneca, criticizing Epicurus, would say that Epicurus's wise man would be able to deal with the suffering and not feel anything. But Seneca recognizes that actually, no, we need to feel. Otherwise, you've missed the boat a little bit. You've become something that's abnormal. You've not really actually, in a sense, probably dealt with the situation. But what it does do is free us from the suffering, and actually, in turn, rather than being so self-absorbed, say, my wife getting ill again, and turning to the bottle, turning to smoke, turning to isolating myself and not really being there for her, and then becoming selfish in that sense, it frees me then to be a servant, like Christ was when he washed the disciples' feet. He knew that he was going to die that evening. He knew he was going to die. But rather than being so self-absorbed, and maybe this is one of his ways of managing suffering and anguish, he served and washed the disciples' feet. And it would be the same with me. I'd serve my wife if she were ever to get ill that way again. I hope. I want it to. So with that also in mind, all of us are going to experience tremendous suffering. All of us are going to get ill. All of us eventually, inevitably, will die. So it's a pressing call that we ought to invest right now our energy, our time, our effort in identifying, understanding a little bit better suffering and the causes and what makes us suffer. If we do that now, how more beautiful would this world be and loving would this world be? Because then we could serve one another, free from the fear of death. And again, that's one of the lovely things in Christianity. And I make no apology for referencing Christianity. I am, as I tried to imply in my last episode, one who's trying to harmonize, one who wants to exist between two worlds, the Western world and the Eastern world. And in Hebrews, for example, in Christianity, it says about Christ removing the fear of death from the dead, because that was the devil's main weapon. But he's removed that fear of death because Christ was resurrected from the grave, which then, for the Christian, enables him to have hope after the grave, being freed in the very moment of suffering. So much to think about. So, in conclusion, the first noble truth is dukkha, suffering. Key things that make up this truth, and I'm sure that I haven't exhausted this truth, nowhere near it, just giving you introductory remarks really that I hope will inspire you. The key words is impermanence, reflect, contemplate, meditate on this, and attachment. Those two words, I will say for now, are intertwined, interwoven into our many experiences of suffering. So be blessed and meditate on suffering. God bless.